Eku iluna, all rise. Kenehone, kaaha ho'okolokolo ho'opi'iku'e. Ukaluna kana vai hanohano o Catherine G. Leonard. Ame kaluna kana vai hanohano o Keith K. Hiraoka. Ame kaluna kana vai hanohano o Kimberly T. Guidry. E'o malune. Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Catherine G. Leonard, the Honorable Keith K. Hiraoka, the Honorable Kimberly T. Guidry presiding. And Ohobi Lalo, please be seated.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Counsel, would you like to make your appearances, please?
Good morning, Your Honor. Robert Richardson on behalf of plaintiff Appellants.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you for the privilege of appearing for Hoppy J. Attorney David Gibbs on behalf of the appellants of the local church.
Okay.
Good morning, Doug Chin and Dwayne Yashiro. We're here on behalf of the defendants and appellees. They include the California Pacific Conference of the United Methodist Church. The conference is represented by Lori Metters, who is its chancellor. She's in the first row recognizing it. Also, its board of trustees. And here in attendance is Tyler Popcher. He's a resident of Honolulu with he's a former trustee. Its district superintendent, Tom Choi, the reverend who's based here in Honolulu, and he's seated here. And also its resident bishop, Dr. Dottie Escobedo.
Please be seated. Before we begin, Mr. Gibbs, I understand you wish 10 minutes of rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
That'll be good. Mr. Chin, you would like a 5-minute warning before your time is out.
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. Welcome, everyone. Appreciate you coming, and it's nice to see you. The court apologizes for the delay in the proceedings. We have the oldest excuse in the book. We were having technical difficulties, and you wouldn't have been able to hear me without shouting, which you didn't want me to do, I'm sure. So thank you for your patience. Mr. Gibbs.
May it please the court, as I indicated previously, I have the privilege of representing the IAEA Korean United Methodist Church, a local church here in Hawaii, and a number of the church members have come out, and thank you for your grace in allowing them to be in your gallery. Your Honor, this case represents, and I'm getting a little, just to make sure that doesn't, this case represents a narrow question. May a Hawaii civil court apply neutral principles of property, trust, and corporate law to determine civil rights in Hawaii, real property owned by an incorporated Hawaii church? And Your Honor, the answer is yes. And this court has already said so in the Redemption Bible College case. As Your Honors are aware, Redemption involved a hierarchical denomination, a denominational manual containing a trust provision, and a dispute over Hawaii church property. This court rejected the argument that ecclesiastical deference deprived the civil court of authority to resolve the property dispute. It held that neutral principles must be applied. And Your Honors, that is all that my client, the local church, is asking for today.
Before you move on, is this a hierarchical relationship, or is it connectional? Is connectional different than hierarchical, and does it matter?
I believe it does matter, and I would answer Your Honor's questions that it is different. If you look at the three types of churches, you have pure hierarchical, most typified by Roman Catholic. The Roman Catholic Church has a top down from the Pope to the whole world. They title the property in their own names. They're fully liable in child abuse or other cases, and that is a pure hierarchical denomination. On the other end, you have what I call pure congregational, maybe Baptist, non-denominational. It's all local. The local church is the one that votes, makes all their own decisions. Then you have what I would call connectional, which is representative of the United Methodist Church. And they operate very locally. So there's a local board that I represent. There's a local church. The property's titled in their name. The United Methodist Church will deny liability. So if there was a child abuse claim, they would say, not our problem, local church's problem. But they do have some connection. Very similar to a trade association, like the American Bar Association or an employment agency, what the United Methodist Church does is they provide a pool of ministers. And they say to the local churches, here's a minister, and the local church pays for the minister, like an employment agency, all the bills, all the costs of the minister, but they provide that. They also then ask for donations to support different causes. But the United Methodist Book of Discipline, which is their 1,222-page document, does refer to connectional, not hierarchical. And I believe, Your Honor, in a factual inquiry that we were deprived of at the lower court because of the jurisdictional bar, that would be a relevant fact. So for today,
so, counsel, given this connectional relationship that you describe between the church and the United Methodist Church, is the Book of Discipline then a contract?
I would say it's definitely a document that creates contractual obligations between the parties. So yes, we would say that it is a contract. And there are parts of the Book of Discipline that are secular. There are parts of the Book of Discipline that may be purely theological. There is no need to look at any of the theology of Methodism to determine the rights in this case. And I would also point out with regard to the Book of Discipline, because this is a little known or talked about fact, but in 2506.1, the Book of Discipline itself defers to state law or local law. So there is almost a conflict of laws provision in the Book of Discipline. And at any point when the Book of Discipline conflicts with law, it says we will defer to the law. So that is in the Book of Discipline. We're not asking this court to decide any doctrine, select a pastor, determine church membership, or review an ecclesiastical decision by an out-of-state denomination. We're only asking this court and the Hawaii courts to determine the civil effects of deeds, corporate documents, trust provisions, and Hawaii property law.
So, counsel, with respect to Section 2553, which governs disaffiliation, that provision specifically refers to like terms and conditions that need to be decided upon disaffiliation, right, by the United Methodist Church. So who would decide, is that, so United Methodist Church needs to determine these terms and conditions. Would that not be religious decisions that implicate religious policy?
Well, and Your Honor, I would say no, and I'll explain why. Obviously, we have a local church. Obviously, we have a denomination. So religion spills all over it just in the name. So I'm not saying there aren't churches involved. But if the churches determined that they disagreed with the change doctrine, at that point, they were entitled to the right to leave the denomination with their real property. And it is a contract between the denomination and the church. We're not asking the courts to determine the sincerity of the beliefs or what the beliefs are, whether the denomination's right, whether the church is right. That would all be irrelevant. The question is, did the denomination honor the contract, the binding contract?
So in this case, though, part of the terms and conditions were that the disaffiliating church needed to pay 50% of the value, right, of the church property. So is that, I mean, what are the limitations in terms of what United Methodists could determine in terms of what terms will be appropriate? I mean, what if United Methodist Church were to say that the disaffiliating church needed to pay three times the amount? Would that be an appropriate term and condition?
The 50% is absolutely inappropriate, but three times would certainly
be. So, but who determines that? If that is not like a question for the civil courts to determine, and that would that be like a religious decision?
Well, respectfully, I would say that is a term for a civil court to determine exactly what happened in California. The same conference determined a 50% payment on the churches in California, and the trial judge determined that that was inconsistent, inappropriate with the contract of 2553. That
what standard was applied?
Contractual interpretation, standard review of words and meanings. And one thing about 2553, Your Honor, is it said no terms could be adopted by the annual conference that are inconsistent with this provision. And this provision spelled out financial terms. I won't bore you with them, but it talked about 2 years of apportionments and any unfunded pension. There was a spelling, and it said the annual conference could add additional terms not inconsistent with this. And I think the concept there was...
Isn't payment of money consistent with the other financial terms?
I'm sorry, sir.
Isn't the payment of money for the disaffiliation consistent with the other terms requiring payments of money?
The California judge said no. We would argue no. We would say, as Your Honor previously asked, what if they said 400% the property value? What if they said 50 million? I mean, they could put any number they so choose. Well, that would defeat the contractual right. And so there's always in a contract the interpretation of implied good faith and dealing, that if we are going to allow this, and Your Honor, just so you're aware, over 7,500 churches left the United Methodist Church under 2553 in all 50 conferences. And there was a pattern and practice. There were standards. Again, none of this was presented to the trial court because we were barred at a jurisdictional level. We were never allowed to bring in the fact that this was not the pattern and practice for the United Methodist Church under 2553. So, typical contract interpretation, no need to get into theology or no need to get into anything ecclesiastical, but contract interpretation.
So your client's position is 50% wasn't too much. It was totally inappropriate because no payment should have been required.
Beyond what the contract required.
Yeah, thank you. You know, you mentioned all of these other churches that were allowed to disaffiliate. All of the decisions that I've read have referred to UMC as hierarchical. Why is that not binding on us?
Well,
same book of discipline.
Even if Your Honor were to say that the UMC is hierarchical, that still does not eliminate the neutral principles analysis on a count-by-count basis. That's identical to the redemption case. And so I answered previously that we believe that the United Methodist Church is connectional, and that would be argued at the trial court level. But even assuming that Your Honor says it is a hierarchical denomination, in the redemption case, they had a manual that contained a trust provision and a dispute over the property. They had actually done discovery and had summary judgment, and the court rejected the argument that ecclesiastical deference deprived the civil court of authority to resolve the dispute. And so, Your Honor, we believe the error in this case was we got dismissed at the threshold level with no count-by-count analysis. It wasn't like we went through each count and looked at it, and it was for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
So if we agreed with you that it shouldn't have been just dismissed in toto, and we vacate, what happens on remand? I mean, what is this was a 12, the only thing ruled on was 12B1, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so we say the court erred in dismissing the case based on 12B1. What is the procedural posture of the case on remand?
What we would say is that you reverse the dismissal and proceedings go forward on the merits. Okay. That there is no, at this point, you don't have a record to look at or to determine validity of land or title or trust. So this would just purely be a reversal of the B1 dismissal.
Okay, but you understand that subject matter jurisdiction can be addressed at any time. And so is your position that this case, after more discovery or fact-finding, either in further proceedings, it could still be dismissed in whole or in part for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
I fully expect the denomination to continue to argue that at every step. So
right.
we are
I'll
aware.
I'll ask Mr. Chin.
But here's one item I do want to at least put into the court's mind.
Yeah.
If we determine that there is no subject matter jurisdiction, none, and it's done, this church holds title to its property. This church operates under its own ecclesiastical board.
Doesn't it hold it in trust for the larger church?
There is an argument in the Book of Discipline.
I thought there was a deed that said that.
There are some deeds that may have reverter clauses, but they're not triggered at this point. And under Hawaii law, you can remove those things as the landowner potentially. So the argument, and I'm just putting it forward, if the church were to unilaterally retitle their property and move forward and say, bye-bye denomination, we're done, and this is our ecclesiastical decision, this same defendant would come to court and sue them and argue that there is jurisdiction.
And that's what happened in Florida, right?
I'm sorry.
Isn't that what just happened in Florida?
No, Florida was the churches went to court.
Wasn't there a counterclaim?
There are different cases. That one is still pending. So, yes, Your Honor, there are some counterclaims going. And there have been some churches that have unilaterally left. So I'm not saying Florida is not generally the jurisdiction. But with all of that, either the court has jurisdiction for both sides, or the court has no jurisdiction for either side.
Well, isn't it dependent not upon sides, but upon what issue is being litigated?
Well, not if it's a jurisdictional bar. I mean, especially when you have no analysis.
Well, if the same two parties are litigating a doctrinal issue, then it's clearly barred by the First Amendment. But if the same two parties are arguing a purely secular issue, such as whether what is this document outside the discipline, this deed, mean under state law? Same two parties, but different result, right?
Well, there could be, but if you take the logic to it, my church could have a theological decision that they no longer line up with the theology of the United Methodist Church, and they want to change the trust clause. And suppose they take it away from the United Methodist Church and they put it with the Global Methodist Church because that lines up with their theology. If they made that change to the deed, all based on theology, and continued, and by the way, the local church pays all their own bills, all their own property, all their own payments, so it's a fully functioning local Hawaiian entity. If they just continued marching forward and just said, United Methodist Church, we no longer need your services, we no longer need your pastors, we no longer need you, and they just go forward on theology, this conference will sue them and come to court and argue the reverse. So if this court were to disagree with my arguments today that we do have a right to a neutral principles analysis under O'Connor and Redemption and the list of Hawaii cases, there is the distinct possibility that if there's truly no jurisdiction, the church will go on its own and be done, and then they'll sue and get thrown out of court and this matter's over.
So in your example, counsel, if your client decides to disaffiliate for purely theological reasons.
Yes.
The ecclesiastical abstention doctrine would apply to that decision.
If Your Honor were to say that neutral principles can't be used, yes.
Isn't that what prompted 2553? The dispute over the recognition of homosexuality.
There are
that was a theological decision that prompted that paragraph being added to the discipline, wasn't it?
There was a dispute that's been simmering in the United Methodist Church for a long time, but yes, I would agree with you that that was why they put in 2553.
And that's doctrinal, wasn't it?
Well,
Or is it a hybrid issue? Is the whole book of discipline is it better construed as something that's both doctrinal and contractual?
Well, it has to be both because they wrote it that way. I mean, so the 1,222 pages will have some that say a minister has to be holy. Well, that's obviously a religious determination. But then when it says if we conflict with local law, we defer to local law, well, that's almost like a choice of law real estate provision. So it's both and. And, Your Honors, you're very familiar with the neutral principles from the United States Supreme Court, then adopted by Hawaii, and then again adopted by this court in the redemption case. And our point is that our claims, at least our argument, is that they are secular and that they can be resolved without interpreting religious doctrine.
Counsel, how do we know that the 50% appraised value charge isn't ecclesiastically based?
Well, I guess you have to look at two things, okay? I mean, I guess anything can be ecclesiastically based, right? I'm a church, I want $50 million. I mean,
why I asked.
Yeah, I mean, so, and my esteemed colleagues on the other side will say everything they do is ecclesiastical.
Yeah, so I'd like the church's position on how we know that that is not a doctrinal controversy.
Well, you would look at the pattern of practice nationally. You would look at the words of 2553. You would look at the intentions of 2553, which everyone will agree was a graceful exit on financial terms where churches could afford it.
Aren't those all factual issues?
Factual issues that were never explored in this case because it was determined pre-count by count review that there was no jurisdiction. So to answer your question, yes. And to answer Chief Justice's question, there could be additional counts that may get dismissed on B1 grounds, potentially. I'm not saying that I believe that, but I'm saying, but that doesn't mean today in a wholesale without a count by count analysis that we do not have a right to have our day in court. If this court, again, were to say, nope, no jurisdiction at all, if it's churches, we're just going to stay out of it, then my client would have to evaluate its options, look at its ecclesiastical determinations, and then decide what to do. But I would say that the neutral principles of Hawaii are pretty broad in terms of what is allowed to be looked at. And we're not asking for faith, worship, ordination, or any theological belief to be evaluated. We're looking at neutral principles, deeds, records, agreements, financial evidence, the party's conduct, even unjust enrichment. If the conference were to take all their property that this Korean congregation has paid for and just say, it's ours now, and you guys are done, well, that just seems horribly inequitable not to have their day in court. And to let them argue, and I think they'll agree with that.
Yes. Sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to go back to section 2506 again,
yes,
where, you know, it contemplates that local law governs questions specifically relating to property formation and operation of corporations and mergers, but it doesn't specifically say anything about interpretation of contracts or what you're asking us to do or the courts to do in this case, which is to interpret the Book of Discipline specifically. So I just wanted your thoughts on that. You know, it doesn't specifically say that local law would govern the interpretation of the Book of Discipline.
Well, and it does, however, when in conflict. I mean, I think and I'm not reading you 2506, you can certainly look at it, but when there is conflict between the two, that it by its own terms defers. And your point is, does it defer on everything? Well, certainly when it comes to property, corporation.
It specifically mentions property, but in asking us or asking the courts to look at and interpret the provisions of the Book of Discipline, the Book of Discipline is you describe it as a contract, but it's also a religious document, right? A religious covenant.
In part, yes. No question.
So I guess, can that be, can you untwine the religious aspects of it from, you know, the secular in terms of interpretation of the provisions of the Book of Discipline?
And I would say yes, and that I fully believe that the trial judges of this state and other jurisdictions are fully capable of calling balls and strikes, that there is a point at which someone may say that's going to require a theological analysis versus that is going to require contractual interpretation, trust law interpretation, neutral principles, things that could be looked at. I mean, even the Hawaii Trust Code is a neutral principle that applies to all trusts here in Hawaii. And to say that, you know, the Book of Discipline would allow a trust to be used illegally or in violation of Hawaii law, my argument would be 2506.1 says from the Book of Discipline itself, and again, I didn't write it, obviously, but that it defers to local law.
Thank you. If you want to save some time.
I would, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Judge Leonard, Judge Hiroka, and Judge Guidry, may it please the court. Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge the presence of all the people watching this proceeding, many of whom identify as current or former members of the United Methodist Church. Like many other local churches around the country, the appellant seeks to disaffiliate from the United Methodist Church due to issues regarding human sexuality, while at the same time keep the local property. But that property is expressly held in trust for the worldwide denomination, according to the governing documents of the United Methodist Church. The United Methodist Church enacted a pathway for local churches to amicably disaffiliate and retain the property if certain conditions were met under Section 2553 of the Book of Discipline. The appellant then sued in Hawaii Civil Court to challenge that internal process.
So wasn't it your position that they did not comply with 2553?
Correct.
Okay. And is that a factual issue? Because their position, as I understand it, is that you prevented them from complying. There was delays. There was, you know, I don't want to misstate their argument.
Sure.
But that determination is a secular one and not an ecclesiastical one.
Your question is whether it's a factual issue. It is a factual issue once you get past subject matter jurisdiction. And so I would like to talk a bit about that, but go ahead. Please, sir.
Don't the facts in this case determine whether or not there is subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, there is a need to look at the face of the complaint as well as the other evidence that's been taken, that the court took judicial notice of, that the ICA now has, in order to be able to determine the factual dispute or the factual challenge regarding subject matter jurisdiction.
So, speaking of factual issues, one of the things the church is challenging is the pension contribution. Is UMC's pension plan and ERISA subject to ERISA?
Yes.
And ERISA is a secular law?
Yes.
So whether or not the plan is or isn't underfunded would be a question of secular law?
That would be the case if that's the answer to that, is that that issue is something that could be decided under secular law. But the reason why the claims do not survive here is because these claims ultimately turn on ecclesiastical abstention, which the Hawaii Supreme Court articulated in O'Connor versus Diocese of Honolulu. And I want to spend just a few minutes on O'Connor, if the court would grant me that opportunity, because I didn't hear any mention of O'Connor in that entire presentation. I heard about Redemption Bible College, and I'm happy to talk about that if the court wants to engage with me on that. But the Hawaii Supreme Court has articulated the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine in O'Connor as follows. I want to spend some time on this because I think one of the statements that will be made is that O'Connor only applies to excommunication. And also what I was hearing in this conversation that the court was having with Mr. Gibbs is that there was a big focus on the fact that doctrine is the only thing that matters. And I want to now read the holding to see what the Hawaii Supreme Court said. They said, we hold that under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 4 of the Hawaii Constitution, civil courts have no authority to resolve disputes that turn on matters of church doctrine, church practice, church polity, or church administration, or that cannot be decided without resolving underlying controversies over any such claims. When faced with such claims, civil courts must dismiss them. And so when you apply the Hawaii Supreme Court opinion there, it's not just what you believe, it's how you believe, it's how you practice your belief, it's how you govern yourself to be able to show the rest of the world that you belong to the United Methodist Church and you are not of the world.
In this case though, this is a case about the interpretation of the Book of Doctrine, right? Which opposing counsel has characterized as a contract. So what is your position on whether, I will ask you the same question.
Sure.
What is your position? Is the Book of Discipline a contract?
We would say it's the governing documents of the United Methodist Church. Meaning, and if I could say something about that, please, it's that even the trust requirement, 2501, section 2501 is cloaked in these words. It says that the trust requirement is an essential element of the historic polity of the United Methodist Church since 1797. It also says the trust requirement is a fundamental expression of United Methodism. And that is really what we're talking about.
So why doesn't trust law apply?
Because this isn't the same world that we are operating in. In other words, because under O'Connor, this matter ultimately turns on issues related to not just church doctrine, but church polity and church administration and church governance.
Isn't this case, though, ultimately about disaffiliation of a church and the property, you know, interpreting the Book of Discipline and the provisions of the Book of Discipline, and specifically section 2553, to sort of determine how the property will be distributed,
sure.
Right? So in that sense, you know, the section 2506 specifically contemplates that local law governs questions relating to property. So why does local law not apply? Why
sure.
can the civil courts not look at just that specific issue about, you know, who gets the property?
So I'll start by agreeing with you that I think this is a dispute about section 2553. In other words, this is a section 2553 dispute and how it should be interpreted, as opposed to a property dispute or a trust dispute. But as to your question regarding why doesn't local law applies, I think one of the things that I see happen in the appellant's arguments, respectfully, is that he often mentions like one part without mentioning the rest of it. So, for an example, saying that that the court can only decide matters or should abstain from church doctrine without mentioning it's also abstaining from matters of church polity, administration, and governance. Here, 2506 does talk about conformity to local laws, but it also says that provided, however, the rest of the sentence continues, and it says, provided, however, that this requirement shall not be construed to give the consent of the UMC to deprivation of its property without due process of law or to regulation of affairs by states where such regulation violates the constitutional guarantee of freedom of religion and separation of church and state, or violates the right of the church to maintain its connectional structure.
So, but doesn't that imply you both have rights under the law?
It does say that it's rights. I don't know if it's saying rights under the law.
Well, but
Judge Leonard,
no,
it's saying that.
Okay, I'm looking at the provision too, Mr. Chin.
Yeah.
It says this requirement shall not be construed to give the consent of the United Methodist Church to deprivation of its property without due process of law. Okay, that implies a process, which implies involvement of the courts, arguably, right?
And certainly, I think the United Methodist Church will, as Mr. Gibbs say, take sometimes, if it needs to, go to civil courts in order to be able to enforce things. But it is also held to the same, or at least in Hawaii, it would be held to the same O'Connor standard that it would need to be able to present an argument or a claim that does not turn.
Or to the regulation of its affairs by state statute where such regulation violates. So this provision, including the provided, however, gives rights to both sides under state law, it appears.
It refers to state laws, and that the United Methodist Church is not consenting to waiving any of that if it needs to. That's how I would characterize it. I realize that the court is looking at it as well. I also want to respond before I forget, because I don't get rebuttal. I think that one argument that has come up is the fact that it would be an argument that O'Connor only applies to excommunication, that it doesn't refer to church property disputes like what we have here. If you look at the O'Connor decision, it cites to about a dozen cases, of which all four of the United States Supreme Court cases that it refers to have to do with church property disputes. And so, starting with Milojevic, it says, First Amendment values are plainly jeopardized when church property litigation is made to turn on matters resolution by civil courts of controversies over religious doctrine and practice. I really want to get to the next one because it's Presbyterian Church versus Hull, versus the Presbyterian Hull Church, which it says this, it's property dispute. It says First Amendment commands civil courts to decide certain church property disputes without resolving underlying controversies over religious doctrine, period. Then the next sentence is, this principle applies with equal force to church disputes over church polity and administration. Watson versus Jones, and then there's Jones versus Wolf. But I think
so. You mentioned church polity a number of times. How do you define that, Mr. Chin, or where should we look?
Sure. Church polity is actually defined in O'Connor. It's a footnote. I don't have O'Connor in front of me, but I will say that they took, and I think it has to do with, it has to do with church governance and how the church governs itself. But I think it's one of the first footnotes right there in O'Connor. I think another concept that's referred to in O'Connor is the matter that that our civil courts are to abstain from matters of ecclesiastical cognizance. And just in preparing for this argument, I just want to note ecclesiastical cognizance isn't just recognition of a church. It's all the things that we're talking about, which is how the church administers itself, how the church decides a pathway for local churches to be able to amicably disaffiliate and possibly keep their property.
So one of the things that counsel for appellants mentioned was that they could just declare themselves disaffiliated and apply their own ecclesiastical doctrine and essentially transfer the property back to themselves. Sure. Would you respond to that?
Thankfully, that is not claims that are in front of us.
Okay.
So in other words, I don't think it's any secret that there's a lot of different strategies that local churches and the denomination will employ to be able to achieve whatever goals that they have. But I think the issue is that here, what we have is a disaffiliation process that is being questioned that ultimately is part of the Book of Discipline, which isn't just doctrine. It's not just what people believe. It's the church polity. It's the administration. It's the governance. And it's their practice.
So if the local church did decide to disaffiliate on its own and take its property, would United Methodist Church be able to sue the local church in state court?
If they did, it's not in front of us, but if they did, then and it happened here in Hawaii, then the denomination should and would be held to the same O'Connor standard, which is that civil courts should only decide things that don't turn on matters of church doctrine, church practice, church polity, or church administration, or that cannot be resolved by looking into those details. I can't emphasize enough that when the Hawaii Supreme Court reached that decision, it did so after a review of all these cases, and then it ends by saying, consequently, we hold rooted in both religion clauses that this is the standard that should be followed.
So in that hypothetical, though, the jurisdictional issue would be raised there, right?
Yes, it could be. It could be, arguably. And I would say, not having done it myself, but my understanding is that what might happen is that if the local church were to transfer their property into another entity, and then declare that the denomination can't get to it, that there might be some sort of action for quiet title or conversion or even breach of fiduciary duty, but those would be held to the same standard. I'm sorry, Judge Leonard.
Right, but I mean, and not to be arguing with you or for Mr. Gibbs, but isn't that why courts should be open to looking at purely property issues? What are the rights or the trust issues? Because if this is held in trust for the conference, then you have rights under the law too. We just discussed it under 2506 Part 1. And aren't those rights, not the reason you get there, not the dispute, the underlying doctrinal dispute, not even, you know, the polity issue of 2553, don't you have a right to seek relief in court, at least jurisdiction?
Judge Leonard, I agree with you. I think that's absolutely right. I think the what's in front of this court right now, though, is claims that are problematic because they ultimately turn on matters of ecclesiastical cognizance. That is the criticism
that we're having. But the circuit court did not examine the six individual claims, just said no jurisdiction. Isn't that correct?
That is true. However, to address that issue, we do cite to State versus Fukugawa, which stands for the ability of the appellate court to be able to review arguments that were made below, and certainly the issue of whether or not the claims could survive 12b6 or even a 12b1 standard were walked through individually, count by count, by both sides. And so we do think that that issue is available for the court to be able to do. And in fact, if the ICA were to affirm the decision and provide more on its de novo review, if it were to provide more substance that went claim by claim and explained why subject matter jurisdiction doesn't apply or the 12b6 standard doesn't apply, that would be in line with what O'Connor did. So in other words, the structure of the O'Connor decision was, here's 12 decisions for U.S. Supreme Court church property disputes. Now we're going to walk through each of the claims that were brought by O'Connor, and then we're going to reach our decision. And that's where and ultimately render a holding.
So if this court were uncomfortable with that level of factual analysis and wanted to vacate and remand, would the issue of subject matter jurisdiction remain open after further, you know, factual development?
It's still open, but sure, of course. However, our position is that the court can reach that now, not just based upon the face of the complaint, but also based upon all of the exhibits and cases that were placed in front of the court, including the quitclaim deed that was subject to a restrictive covenant that had expressed language placing the property in trust for the denomination.
One of the things that the IEA Church is arguing is that the 50% of the real property tax assessed value is a punitive payment. Mm. Does that requirement have an ecclesiastical purpose or basis?
Yes.
What is it?
Yes. So it would be a matter of church polity or church governance. And let me please...
Well, polity means a particular form or system of government. I don't see how that, the decision to charge 50% of the real property tax assessed value involves polity. It may involve something else, right. And which is what I'm asking you.
No, I appreciate that. So then I would say it falls under church governance, meaning this is how the church is choosing to govern itself in wrestling with a thorny issue that has occurred in the 21st century regarding what to do with our shift in doctrine, our shift as opposed to, with respect to matters of human sexuality and what we do with local churches
so
that want to disaffiliate.
I'm sorry.
What about Aya's argument that 2553 only permits additional terms that are consistent with the other provisions and the 50% is not consistent?
I'd like to address that because the way the First Amendment complaint reads, it says annual conferences may develop additional standard terms that are not inconsistent, and then they end quote. And then they say, not inconsistent with Section 2553. The implication being, well, there was no mention of appraised value, 50% there. That is not what Section 2553 says. If you complete the sentence, it says, annual conferences may develop additional standard terms that are not inconsistent with the standard form of this paragraph, meaning the standard form for disaffiliation agreements, which is in the record on appeal under docket 59, Exhibit 3, and then internally with it, I'll say it one more time, Circuit Court Docket 59. It's a bit buried, but Exhibit 3 has an internal exhibit, and that's another Exhibit C. It has an internal exhibit, Exhibit 3. Okay. That's where you find the standard form of disaffiliation. Okay. And what you see is you see a bunch of different paragraphs that talk about payment for annual unfunded liabilities or apportionments. And after each of those paragraphs, there then is a blank that says dollar amount. At the very end, there's another section that says other payments as determined by the annual conference with the advice of their financial board and all of that. And so if you look at the face of 2553, then the annual conference, this annual conference's decision to impose the 50% appraised value here is not inconsistent with the standard form of disaffiliation. It's right there, and it was something that could be expected.
So could the annual conference have chosen any percentage that...
Sure. Oh, great question, and I think that goes to the extreme...
That's what I wanted to ask if United Methodist Church could have imposed, as I asked... the other side, like three times the amount.
Right.
Could the United Methodist Church have done that?
Right. So what I'll say is, thank goodness that's not the circumstances here. Mm-hmm. So we're not testing the edge of this ecclesiastical abstention doctrine. However, what I would say is that if it does follow an issue of church governance, if we're talking about an issue of church governance, then yes, ecclesiastical abstention applies.
In that situation, what would be the recourse for the local church if they couldn't go to, you know, civil court?
The recourse is for them to work it out through the church, whether that's through the United Methodist Church Judicial Council, of which there are decisions in our record that uphold Section 2553 as valid, and then also say that 2553 is the only path to disaffiliation at that time. Those are the highest decisions of the Judicial Council for the United Methodist Church. I also want to mention something before I forget about the concern about how unfair this might potentially be. I hear that. In other words, that is natural for a secular court to be able to think and apply secular values to things and to be eager to handle it if it believes it is secular in nature. I just want to point out that this was cited by O'Connor. So it's the block quote from Milojevic. And it says, "It is the essence of religious faith that ecclesiastical decisions are reached and are to be accepted by as matters of faith, whether or not rational or measurable by objective criteria. concepts of due process, including secular notions of fundamental fairness or impermissible objectives, are therefore hardly relevant to such matters of ecclesiastical cognizance.
Part of your ecclesiastical doctrine, if I accept that argument, is that concepts of due process apply to the implementation of the Book of Discipline. We remember we just went over 25. So that is your doctrine.
Well, what this is saying is it's saying that those concepts of due process wouldn't apply.
Right. If you have right. That. They right. wouldn't, except that you agreed to them. Right. And that's, I mean, Mr. Chin, we are aware that O'Connor is a Hawaii Supreme Court decision, but it is not limited to excommunication in the broader doctrine, but it is a very different case. You would have to admit that.
It is. However,
and there's
the cases that it surveyed
like,
are not.
Right. But there's nothing like the provisions of the Book of Discipline that we are now peering over discussed in that case, is there?
Not the O'Connor facts on its face. Okay. However, the Supreme Court cases, Milojevic, Blue Hull, Presbyterian, Jones versus Wolf, Watson versus Jones, this is exactly the playground they were in. It's talking about what can a local church do to potentially keep their property and whether or not a denomination is able to hold on to it. I mean, that is something that's existed since the 1870s through the 1950s through the 1970s.
Is this consistent with their doctrine of the neutral principles of law? This view that this is all ecclesiastical, but I thought they also came up with the application of the neutral. I don't have those cases in front of me right now, but the neutral principles of law apply.
Right. So here's how I learned it. It's and figured it out in preparing for this. It's that Sparksburg says that states can decide whatever standard that they want to apply in order to basically to show respect and deference for the Establishment Clause. And one of those ways is hierarchical deference, which is part of Watson versus Jones. Another way is neutral principles. And yes, the Redemption Bible College case did refer to that. I would say, with all due respect, I think that the O'Connor Hawaii Supreme Court did was reconcile those principles and establish a Hawaii standard. That in other words, what they were saying is we because they cited two neutral principles in Jones versus Wolf. They also cited to plenty of quotations in their decision that referred very much to deference to the ecclesiastical authority of the administration or the highest judicial tribunal.
Is this a hierarchy? Is there something in the record that establishes this as a hierarchical church as opposed to a connectional church?
Yes. We would say that shows up in paragraphs 26 and 27, the first amended complaint. Now, of course, not that the appellant says that the United Methodist Church is hierarchical. However, what they do say in paragraph 5 is they say the plaintiff church is a local church under defendant's governing umbrella. And then in paragraph 26, they say the discipline is the constitution and governing document of the United Methodist Church. And in addition, they have more paragraphs there, starting from paragraph 19, that talk about the organizational structure and the hierarchy that exists within the United Methodist Church. Before I forget, I wanted to just address the issue of the fact of whether or not connectional or hierarchical, does that make a difference? We don't think so. So in other words, in Watson versus Jones, the distinction that it made was two buckets. It said there's congregational churches, and then there's hierarchical or connectional. So they didn't have three buckets, as Mr. Gibbs is trying to say. They just had two, and hierarchical or connectional was part of what was in the same bucket that received the same kind of.
Was that at issue in the case? A distinction or similarity between hierarchical
and
connectional?
I think so. I would say yes, because it was discussed. And I also want to point out that in Carnes versus Smith, that's a Georgia Supreme Court case that's cited by Jones versus Wolf. Carnes versus Smith also points out that there is no difference between hierarchical or connectional in terms of moving on from there to be able to then decide, okay, once we have a hierarchical church, what are we doing? And I know that we haven't talked about Baldinato, but just to be very clear about that, Baldinato was plainly in the congregational camp, and so the ICA very quickly went there. I will just say something about Redemption Bible College. So even though that was a church property dispute, and I know, Judge Leonard, you were part of that panel, it at least appears to me that in that case that it is only treated in a footnote. And really what's happening there is a title dispute. In other words, the issue going on there was whether or not the title had been conveyed by fraud or whether the person who was conveying title on behalf of the church actually had authority to do so. That makes sense. That is squarely a neutral principles analysis that does not touch on matters of church polity or administration. So we are not asking, I think I saw in some of the papers, we're not asking the court to blindly abstain from handling any of these matters. That's not a standard. The standard is ecclesiastical abstention. So it's not blind. It's with eyes wide open to the fact that we have a First Amendment in the United States that has an establishment clause that provides minimum protection to the states under the 14th Amendment. But we also have Articles 1, Section 4, and then we also have the Hawaii Supreme Court that didn't just limit decisions to matters of church doctrine, but also to church polity, practice, and administration. I see that my time has expired, and I think my voice is going, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you very much.
Your Honor, just very briefly in rebuttal, with all due respect to my esteemed colleague, I believe O'Connor clearly made Hawaii, which I do agree it is a Hawaii issue, a neutral principles state. And as this court interpreted it in the Redemption case, he's trying to blend. And by the way, Florida is a deference state. And a deference state is constitutionally permissible under the United States Supreme Court. And what a Florida court would say is we kind of defer to denominations. What a neutral principle state like Hawaii says is no, it's neutral, and we look at it under law. Our six counts, declaratory judgment, that can be done neutrally. Who holds title? There's deeds, there's corporate charters under Hawaii's property law. Trust modification, is a trust clause valid and enforceable under the statutes 554D, 401, 412, 415? Those are trust law questions this court perfectly capable of reviewing. Breach of fiduciary duty, whether breach duties were owed under Hawaii's corporate and fiduciary law requires no interpretation of church doctrine. Unjust enrichment, whether the corporate denomination received a benefit at the local church's expense, is a standard equity inquiry. It's money. It's what courts deal with all the time. Promissory estoppel, whether we reasonably relied on the denominational representations, is a contractual reliance question. Again, things courts deal with all the time under neutral principles. Lastly, breach of contract. Whether they breached the disaffiliation agreement with inconsistent terms, as you've already pointed out under 2553, as was litigated in California, turns on a contract. And interpretation follows ordinary contract law principles. And respectfully to the trial judge, she did not perform the claim-by-claim analysis that is required to determine whether the local church's rights under neutral principles were protected. One or two comments on the Judicial Council, just to make it very clear. That's an internal administrative pastor's council. The local churches have no access to it. And I just want to make sure that everybody understands it's not like an arbitration panel or anything that we can go to. It's limited to bishops, conferences, and they have to take things up kind of in a administrative ecclesiastical manner. So there isn't like any option. And basically his point is our only dynamic is to go to the denomination that won't let them leave, wants 50% of the property value. And I think the property's appraising in the $20 million range. So, I mean, you're saying $10 million to a, Korean congregation with 300, 400 people. It's impossible. And so go to them and just basically whatever they say happens, happens. And Your Honors, we would respectfully disagree that is our only option. We believe that the courts should be open. We at least deserve discovery to demonstrate that neutral principles could resolve our claims. Looking at the deeds, the corporate records, the agreements, the financial evidence, the party's conduct. And Your Honor, my client is only asking for what any property owner in Hawaii is entitled to, and that's a day in court. The neutral principles framework that this court adopted in O'Connor provides that path. And so respectfully, I would ask this court to reverse and remand and allow the local church's case to go forward. I think I have a couple minutes if there's any questions, but otherwise, thank you for your time and your attention to this matter.
Thank you. Before we break today, I want to say one thing that this court agreed on as we were prepping for this case is counsel for both sides did a really good job here in the briefing. It was helpful to the court, and we appreciate that you're representing your clients well. And we will take this matter under advisement, and we thank you for appearing here today and arguing before this court.
Eku iluna, all rise. Ua ho'oku'u ia mai nei ka'aha. Court is now adjourned.